Brexit? What Brexit? All right, it's not that simple, but still, something to think about. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, June the 29th. Great, as always, to have you here, everybody. We will stipulate right at the outset that there is much yet to be known about how this whole Brexit thing is going to play out. Yes, the markets are one metric, about which more later. But sitting where we are on Brexit plus six, it is not unreasonable to begin to kind of maybe sort of think that the economic jolt that is coming, because there will be one, but perhaps the jolt that is coming might be more regional than global. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson tests the hypothesis.
The UK has dropped a big old stone in the water. The economic ripples will be felt there the strongest, a little weaker in the EU and beyond.
In general, this is a regional EU UK shock. It is not a global economic shock.
Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, in a webinar this morning, he says this won't be such a big deal for the rest of the world, as long as other countries don't follow the UK out of the EU.
So best case scenario, we have a sharp downturn in the UK.
Eric Jones is a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He says we know already that all this uncertainty about the UK's future relationship with the EU will hit its economy hard.
There's going to be a smaller shock in the euro area. It's a bigger economy, but a smaller shock. And then those two things are going to exert some drag on the world writ large.
But again, that's best case scenario. Worst case, he says Europe's banks haven't fully recovered from the financial crisis, that other countries could leave the EU. Aaron Klein is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Usually when periods of disruption and disintegration begin, they take a little longer to play out. If Brexit is the first shoe to drop, rarely is it simply a one-time thing. Usually there are other difficulties in the process.
He says Brexit may be less a one-time event, more a harbinger of things to come. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Harbinger, that's never a good word. The vote breakdown last Thursday was pretty clear. Scotland and Northern Ireland voted Remain. Most of England, except for London, voted Leave. The Remain-oriented capital is prosperous and diverse, and voters in the top global financial hub that it is voted 2-1 to stay, which has left many of them, as Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard reports, unhappy and apprehensive.
Here's something I've never seen before. Several thousand people in the pouring rain chant, EU, we love you. Among them, a young mother, Patricia Ferguson, says the vote for Brexit is anti-immigrant and therefore anti-London.
Look around you. Look at our city. Look, what makes London special, what makes London dynamic and a living city is it's welcoming to people from everywhere. You want to be a Londoner, you can be a Londoner. And I think taking us out of the EU can only be bad for our city.
Another young protester here, Sharla Q, says last Friday's shock result knocked her sense of national identity.
I felt more of a Londoner than an English person, and definitely more of a European than a citizen of the United Kingdom.
Many Londoners, like many Scots, feel they're being taken out of the EU against their will. They're demanding at least to play a part in deciding the terms of the divorce. So they should, says Andrew Carter of the Centre for Cities. The capital and its financial services are a golden goose for the whole of Britain.
25% of the economy comes out of London. 30% of the national tax take comes out of London. If London does badly as a result of the deal that's struck, the nation will do badly as well.
The atmosphere is funereal here at the London Chamber of Commerce. The shock of the Brexit vote hasn't worn off. The head of the chamber, Colin Stanbridge, says he's now uncertain about the capital's future prosperity.
Is this financial centre in jeopardy?
It's too early to say what the jeopardy really is to the financial centre, but there's an awful lot of worried faces around.
He says London must keep its unfettered access to the EU single market and do nothing to deter talented Europeans from coming to work here. Otherwise, London's financial centre could lose much business to rival financial hubs in continental Europe.
You think it's possible that London could pass its crown to Frankfurt or Paris?
I hope not.
But it's possible.
Of course it's possible.
But economist Ruth Lee, who voted for Brexit, says it's inconceivable that even after leaving the EU, London could be toppled as Europe's main financial centre.
Frankfurt isn't a serious competitor, neither is Paris. And it's not just the fact we speak English and we're in the right time zone. It is also that we have a unique talent pool here and we have a unique global reach, which makes us a proper global financial sector. Perhaps some of the jobs will move, but I wouldn't expect a wholesale move. London is just too attractive.
And yet, London's reach into the rest of the EU and its talent pool could both shrink if the divorce gets messy and the UK fails to extract an attractive deal from its European partners. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Our newsletter goes all Brexit all the time. Today, you can subscribe at marketplace.org. All right, so about the markets, that thing I said in the open, what Brexit? Wall Street was what I was talking about. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Facebook made some news today in pretty much the same way Facebook always makes news, by announcing a tweak or a tuck to this feature or that. In this case, a tweak to the algorithm that rules its news feed, that scrolling list of posts you see when you log on. In short, family and friends go to the top of the list, news and non-user-generated content, that is, brands and publishers, that is, furthermore, the New York Times and BuzzFeed and us, get bumped down. As we usually do when this kind of thing happens, we got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. Question number one has got to be, why is Facebook doing this?
Isn't that always the question?
Well, yeah, kind of is.
Why? Why? Well, and the answer is the same as it always is. And that answer is to make you and me and every other user of Facebook want to spend more time on Facebook. It's to make the news feed more interesting. It's to address the kind of ongoing complaint that people are feeling a little bit bored by their news feeds. They aren't sharing as much personal information as they used to. There's empirical data to support that. It's down about 21%, in fact, from last year, just the amount of personal posts that people put up. And they're trying to improve that ratio because that's the stuff that people find interesting. And as part of doing that, they're going to bury some of the links to news articles, maybe some of the quizzes, maybe some of the videos, so that it can be more about you and your friends and the gossip that we all know we're actually there for in the first place.
Okay, but, or I suppose I could say, however, comma, didn't Facebook or haven't they in the past couple of years gone all in on their publishers, right? Instant articles, live videos. They are paying other content providers to provide videos for them, for crying out loud.
They are. And in response, those publishers have, in some cases, gone all in on Facebook as a distribution source. It reminds me of the story about the scientific experiment where researchers fed rats at totally intermittent random times. They would reward them when the rats had no idea it was coming, and eventually the rats went insane. That's what publishers and marketers have to be feeling about Facebook, because there is no stable ground.
All right, so
the only thing that Facebook can say to them in response is, look, trust us, we're going to keep people on the site longer. And if you make good content, those users are going to share it and they're still going to see it.
Here's the expectations question, I guess, then now. What do we as users, how should we think of Facebook? Is it a news organization or a news site because so many people get their actual news from Facebook now? Or is it, you know, cute bunny rabbits and kids that I went to elementary school with?
I think what Facebook is hoping, and the thing they keep doing with the news feed, is that what you see on Facebook is exactly what you will want to see. If it's a news site for you, it will continue to be a news site because that's the stuff you'll respond to. That's the stuff you'll see when your friends post, because your friends are probably into news too. If you want it to be about cute bunnies and who gained weight since high school, it will be that. And that's their entire goal.
And the end result of all this is that we stay on it longer. Our data becomes more useful to them. Advertisers can capitalize on that. And then Facebook makes more money because it's a company.
Yeah, it's really simple. The longer you spend on Facebook, the more money Facebook makes. And everything they do is in service of that goal.
All right. Go look up Molly Wood's Facebook page or my Facebook page or the Marketplace Facebook page. You know where to find it. Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure.
Coming up.
The post office was absolutely essential to start the national market.
Oh, for the days when snail mail was king. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 284 points today, 1.6%, 17,694. The NASDAQ gained 87 points, 1.8%, 4779. The S&P 500 added 34 points, about 1.7%, 2,070 there. If you are an everyday American, you probably do not have money in iPath S&P 500 VIX short-term futures, do you? So you probably did not see them shoot up 30% after the Brexit vote, did you? Well, let me explain. VIX futures rise when the market is volatile. That is what you need to know. You want the VIX arrow pointing down, and it is down 20% since Monday, which is, as Tracy was telling us, that whole regional hypothesis. Bond prices? Well, they were down. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.50%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A story now about how the system actually works. This morning, GE Capital was officially scratched off the too-big-to-fail list. The Financial Stability Oversight Council decided General Electric's financing arm has slimmed itself down well enough so that it's no longer a threat to bring the whole system crashing down around it were it to fail. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports on progress.
American taxpayers have one more reason to rest easy tonight, says Dennis Kelleher with the consumer advocacy group Better Markets.
GE got rid of its high-risk finance gambling and got back to the business that it makes money at, which is airplane engines and all sorts of other industrial products.
In the last year, GE Capital has sold off $180 billion of its business. Federal regulators say those moves, quote, reduce the potential for GE Capital's financial distress to threaten U.S. financial stability. But right now, just two other non-banks, insurance giants Prudential and AIG, carry this too-big-to-fail label.
The idea that we're going to prevent financial catastrophes by designating two insurance companies as systemically important just doesn't strike me as very probable.
That's Harvard Law professor Hal Scott. Scott wants to see the feds regulate sketchy products or services, not companies. For example, if people invest in some kind of high-risk fund.
So what you might want to do is say, well, these funds have to have liquidity, they have to have assets, and therefore have the cash to honor redemption. So that's an approach where you're basically looking at what the companies are doing and making sure that they're not running too much risk.
Dennis Kelleher says that sounds smart and tactical, but it mirrors a financial industry talking point to maximize profits.
The industry approach is to keep clipping the wings of the regulators. Oh, don't do this, don't do that. Let's leave it to the experts who are worried about the public interest to decide which firms to designate and how best to do it.
Kelleher says GE Capital reducing its risk is proof these labels are onerous enough to get a company's attention. If anything, he says he wants more companies to carry it around. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Wimbledon, the All England Club, the championships, as the branding goes, isn't just about tennis this year. It's also about tennis fashion victims, more accurately, courtesy of Nike. The company issues standard outfits every year to the female players that it pays to wear its clothes, outfits that often set the trends for athletic wear that end up on the mass market down the line. But as Gigi Dubin reports, that is probably not going to be the case this year because Nike's new tennis clothes failed to take one big thing into consideration, the tennis.
You could say Wimbledon gets a little uptight about what players wear. Outfits can't be too revealing, and they have to be white. Not off-white, not cream, white. Nike got the white part right. But the dress? Let's just say it's been dubbed the Nike Nighty.
It's basically a glorified shirt.
Beth Espinette teaches product design at the University of Oregon. She says a good tennis dress gives total freedom of movement and doesn't get in the way of the game.
But I imagine that it's a lot of tugging and pulling and brushing aside.
That's because Nike's dress is a tiny baby doll with two big slits along each side. Just try returning a 120-mile-an-hour serve in that thing. Karen Burgess blogs about tennis apparel at tennisidentity.com. She says when the dress debuted during qualifying rounds last week,
their bellies were showing, their backs were showing, and they don't want to think about that while they're playing, that so much of their body is showing.
So Nike sent in seamstresses and made adjustments. Players made them too. One tucked the dress into her shorts. Another used her headband as a belt. Nike says it's still selling the dress as is for $100. And Burgess says women will probably buy it.
I think it's going to bring a lot of attention to it, a lot of curiosity about it.
She says brands used to make dresses only for players. Then they got smart. Fans want to wear what their favorite athletes wear. Serena Williams tweeted yesterday, "Kinda in love with my Wimbledon dress." That could be because she's not wearing the Nike Nighty. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
We're out this week with the third installment of the National Economic Survey we've been doing since late last fall, the Marketplace Edison Research Poll. One of the new questions we asked this time was how people are feeling about their chances in this economy, specifically whether they feel the economy is rigged. The answer from 71% of all the people we talked to was you betcha. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on who feels that way and why.
Democrats, Republicans, young, old, rich, poor, blacks, whites, and Hispanics, majorities of all those groups told us, yes, the economy is rigged. About 83% of the African Americans we polled felt this way, including Brad Lewis. He lives in Washington's Anacostia neighborhood.
Nancy?
Brad.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, come on in.
I step into Brad's bright yellow house. I find out Brad's 57. He's a health benefits consultant. Yeah. One way he sees the economy as rigged, the struggle to get a loan or credit card.
So it's much harder to get good credit if, for say, you're a lower or moderate income person of color who lives in a urban area.
Brad says he's in the middle class, barely.
I do sometimes feel like I'm clinging to the middle class because just the daily or the monthly expenses are getting higher and you're wondering, well, my income isn't necessarily matching that.
Brad says he chats with his neighbors about this all the time. They feel the same way. He picks up the phone and calls one.
Yeah, hey, how's it going? So I've been interviewed for a couple of minutes.
Crystal Banks comes right over.
How are you?
Crystal Banks.
Hi, Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Hi.
Thank you for coming over. I really
Crystal was happy to chat. We gave her a break from her crying 2-year-old grandson, who lives with her, along with her daughter. I asked her whether the economy is rigged. She talked about who the economy is rigged against.
For someone who is just getting out of prison, who really, really wants to get a job and go do the right thing, and they are not able to because they have this thing that follows with them.
I tell Crystal I talked to someone who answered our poll who considers himself wealthy, and even he agrees the economy is rigged. For him, he'd even be willing to pay more taxes.
Wow, he sounds like a great guy.
The guy is Alan Johnston. I went to see him, too, along with his wife, Anne Cross.
Your house is spotless.
We sit down across from a brick fireplace in their sunny, antique-filled living room. Alan and Anne live in the Maryland suburbs of Washington. They're both demographers. He's retired. She's semi-retired. Alan was the first in his family to go to college. He worked hard over the years. He saved up enough money that now, he says, he's in the top 5%.
The system's rigged, and it's to my benefit. I don't think that's a good thing, but it is.
Now, I asked everyone I interviewed if the economy can be unrigged fixed so it's more equal. Everyone said yes, but Alan was the only one who had a specific plan. He's thought about this a lot. He says, make the tax system more progressive so the rich pay a bigger share of their income to the taxman. He says he knows a lot of people who feel the same way.
Yes, we talk about it, and if they have enough income, then they have to pay more taxes. That's fine with them.
There's just one problem, says Barry Lynn of New America. He researches economic inequality, and he says there's a growing gap between the very rich in the top 1% and the Alan Johnstons in the top 5%, a gap the 5%ers don't even see.
They're not noticing so much as the breach that's opening between them and the people above them. And that's opening a lot faster than the one between them and the folks below them.
And Lynn says the very rich, those in the top 0.5%, are doing fine under the current system and may not think it's rigged at all. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
More stories coming the rest of the week out of the latest edition of the Marketplace Edison Research Poll. Meanwhile, we've got all the data online if you want to dig in, and at marketplace.org. A quiz. Find out where you fall in our Economic Anxiety Index. The post office is one of America's oldest institutions, and at the same time, one of the most peculiar. Not really government anymore, not really a private sector enterprise, yet still vital. What is clear is that without the United States Postal Service, as it's now called, this country would have been a very different place. Winifred Gallagher tells that story in her new book. It's called How the Post Office Created America. Good to have you on.
Thank you.
You're not kidding. The post office did basically create America, right?
Yes, it certainly did. We have to remember that when America started out, it was a wilderness, and even the big towns and cities were just a tiny little narrow band on the East Coast. Everything had to be built from scratch. So the post office was absolutely essential to start the national market.
What happened? Because I'm not sure that people in this country today have that grand a vision. And I say this honestly, not to be disparaging, but I don't think people think of the U.S. Postal Service with those lofty views.
No, unfortunately, what most people think is that, email killed the post office. That's not true.
You don't buy that?
The post office was at its most powerful, say, between 1880 and World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened, a terrible confluence of things. First of all, the expense of the two world wars and the Depression basically starved the post office of resources so it couldn't automate. At the same time that America's mail volume doubled, they were still working with tools that Benjamin Franklin knew.
Let me posit then that if it's not email that killed the post office, I wonder if you'd agree with this statement, that maybe what killed the post office was the Congress of the United States and the federal government.
Oh,
by,
yes.
By spinning off the U.S. Postal Service and congressional meddling and mismanagement and restrictions that no real American company would have to deal with. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. It receives no tax dollars, but as you pointed out, it's subjected to congressional scrutiny, and it has to provide universal service at a very low cost, regardless of their sometimes very high cost. So it has to operate in these constraints that no business would accept, yet it has to support itself on its own income. So that's very difficult right off the bat. The real issue around email, they were just too timid to join the digital revolution in the 80s from paper mail to email. And Congress and the postal management, they just dropped the ball.
Let me get you then to your last chapter, the title of which is Wither the Post. Here we are, early 21st century. Where's the post office going?
I think the most likely thing to happen would be to age gracefully. The post office will have ceded the digital stuff to private enterprise. But it's still a phenomenal physical delivery system.
You mentioned before we turned on the microphones that you split your time. You spend half the year in Wyoming. What's the post office like there for you? Do you go down every day and pick up your letters, or does somebody come by?
Absolutely.
Down a dusty road or something?
You don't go. We have a city hall, but I don't think I've ever been to it. The post office is the nerve center of our little town, 960 people. Of those 960 people, the vast majority could have home delivery of mail, but do you know how many do?
Six.
Everybody wants to go to the post office and get their mail. And if you're having a bad hair day, you wear a hat.
It's a great history. It's called How the Post Office Created America by Winifred Gallagher. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, keep calm and carry on. That'll be $28,500, please. You've seen the poster reprints, of course, and the coffee mugs and the rest. It turns out that an original keep calm and carry on poster, first printed by the British government in 1939, has been found and put up for auction, £21,000, about 28 grand. You do have to wonder how much David Cameron would pay, huh? All right, so for now, anyway, Brexit. What Brexit? The Dow Industrial is up 284 points, 1.6%. The NASDAQ gained 87 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 up 34 points, 1.7%. Remember, it's just a theory, right? This whole Brexit, what Brexit thing? Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.